Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Carl Hyacin, author of the wonderful new novel for young readers, Flush, published by Knopf. In the weeks to come, we have Michael Connolly, Zadie Smith, Audrey Niffenegger, Nicholas Evans, Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Al Franken, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. It's time to begin.
Before we get started, I would like to ask everybody to turn off their cell phones and pagers for the presentation portion of the evening. And just a reminder, some of the stipulations this evening. Tonight, Carl will be signing one adult title per person with a copy of Hooter Flush, unlimited copies of Hooter Flush, personalizing children's titles only, and you can take photographs while he's talking, but not during the signing. So with that said, I would like to thank you all for coming to the Tattered Cover this evening and supporting your local independent bookstores. When was the last time any of you asked one of your friends to jump on the handlebars of your bike and pump them across town? Well, you may know our guest tonight for his best-selling adult mystery novels, or maybe even for his regular column in the Miami Herald, but have you read his young adult titles? Who's read his young adult titles? Oh, very good. Thank you. I am, of course, talking about none other than author Carl Hyacin. To the young adult world, he first brought Hoot. The bright characters are eco-friendly, and the setting is in his familiar Florida. In 2005, Hoot was awarded the Newbery Honor, which recognizes excellence in children's literature. Tonight, he is here to present his new young adult title, Flush. So please join me in welcoming Carl Hyacin.
Thank you, Beth. And thank everybody for coming and raising their hands when she prompted you to raise your hand. I'm sure they were entirely truthful. I started writing books for young adults, for young readers. An editor had called me up and said to me, have you ever thought about writing for kids? And my response was, are you out of your mind? Have you not read any of the adult books yet? Why would you want to unleash that kind of writing on the youth of America? And she said, because we think you have something to say, do you want to give it a try? And then I end up thinking about it, and I had all these kids in my family, my stepson and my own nieces and my nephew and a lot of other relatives who wanted to read a book that I had written, and I had not written a book that I felt safe giving them. So that's how Hoot got actually started. That was my whole reason for writing Hoot, and I had no idea it was going to take off and be as successful as it was, and I was as stunned and surprised as everybody else was about it. They just finished shooting the film of that book down in Florida, and I wanted to tell you some funny stories. I've only had one other book turn into a movie, and I suspect that most of you in this audience haven't seen it. I'm hoping the younger people haven't seen it. And I'll just say that the characters in Hoot wear a lot more clothes than the characters in that particular movie wore. This was something I felt kind of special about because a longtime friend of mine, Jimmy Buffett, had called me. His daughter had read the book, and he said, I have never done a movie before, but I wouldn't mind producing this movie. And I said, do you know anything about producing movies? He says, I know nothing about it. I said, this is perfect. This is exactly, because that's what we need to do, is sort of get it away from Hollywood. So Jimmy knows a lot of people in high places in Hollywood who are parrot heads and fans of his, and he was able to make a few phone calls. And next thing I know, there's like a movie thing going on. And he arrives at my house in the Keys by seaplane. He flies in by seaplane. And I have to go get him in my boat. I bring him to the house, and that's how we had our meetings. About he and the director would come down the plane. He'd call me from the plane, and he'd say, "Is there any you know, and there would be lobster pots and all. And I'd say, no, you could land over this way. And he would literally, that's how we did it. And it was a fun way to put the project together. And then the Hollywood studios got involved, and of course it turned into the usual cluster arrangement. And I'm doing pretty good with this young audience so far. But we had some interesting times. That book was about some little owls that are on this property, little burrowing owls, which really exist in Florida, existed, I should say, where I grew up in Florida, and they all got buried by bulldozers because they weren't protected at all when I was a kid. So the story of Hoot was really ripped out of my own childhood. And I had, me and my friends, and we had made some valiant but failed efforts to stop these owls from being killed, but we didn't succeed. So I thought I'd write a book where the kids made a difference and they actually pulled it off. And initially the studio said, well, we love this story, but now you got to help us. We're going to have to build these owls. And I said, what do you mean build these owls? And we were going to use mechanical owls, of course. And all I could think about was that little gopher in Caddyshack. And I'm thinking, man, I don't really want you to make mechanical owls. Not that I have anything to say about it, but I talked to Jim, and he said, no, we're not going to use mechanical owls. So my sister, who is a biologist and knows a lot of people in Florida, she comes up with some places where they had some of these little burrowing owls in captivity because they were injured or they couldn't be released. So I ended up with three burrowing owls. And by the miracle of what's called CGI in Hollywood, which is computer-generated imaging, they're going to turn somehow these three owls into a multitude, a biblical multitude of owls. But in any case, so they had to shoot a few scenes where the owls pop out of these holes. And they live in the ground, so they manufacture these phony holes, and they come in with the owls. And the owls aren't really happy to be there under any circumstances. And they figured out pretty quickly this isn't their real den, because there's like 17 guys with lights and cameras and... So they had to figure out how do we get the owls to pop out of these holes so we can photograph them, and they came up and they arrived one day with a vat of crickets, of live crickets, and they attach a live cricket to this little stick, so when you see the dailies, which are the film they shoot every day of these scenes, and in the scene you see the stick come into the frame with a little cricket on it, and the owls have great eyes, terrific eyes, and they're down in this. And they see the cricket, and they come bounding out and snap the cricket up, of course, and they look happy as they can be, and then they go right back down the hole. But when they do the movie, you're not going to see, with the computer, they can literally erase the stick and the cricket and also the little handcuffs that they have on the little owl legs to keep them from flying away, apparently. I was watching it. They sent me the DVDs of the Daily Show, and I said, Jesus, look at, they've got the little manacles on these owls. How are we going to explain that? And they said, oh, don't worry. You won't see those when the movie comes out. So, and there's a scene in that book, and for the kids that remember it, there's a character in there who's one of my favorite characters, this kid named Mullet Fingers, who lives sort of, he doesn't go to school, he lives out in the woods, and he's recruited in this effort. I mean, he's really single-handedly trying to save these owls until these other kids get involved, and he gets his name because he can catch this fish barehanded. And in Florida, we have a very common bait fish called a mullet, which you catch. It's saltwater fish, and they travel in big schools. But they're real slippery, and you could never in a million years catch one in your bare hands. But this kid has this almost magical ability to do that. And so they have to recreate this scene for the movie. And they'll do some stunt stuff, but they did have to have some mullet swimming by the boat and the kid reaching into the water. And there's billions of mullet in South Florida. I mean, they're everywhere, and they're very common bait. You know, fishermen use them for bait all the time. They put them on a hook, and they tarpon, snook, all kinds of fish. And so I think this is not going to be a problem. We got enough mullet. No, it is a problem because the studio says, no, we can't use your mullet. We have to. They fly in a guy from the Humane Society in California. And he's going to be the mullet monitor. And he's got a huge tank of mullet that he's gotten from some mullet sanctuary somewhere. And the director of the movie is Will Schreiner, who's a very funny guy. And he was a stand-up comic for years, and he's an actor. And he's directed a lot of great sitcoms, Frasier and others. And he grew up in Fort Lauderdale like I did. And he calls me one day. He says, "You can't believe what happened. The mullet guy shows up." And I mean, I said, "You mean the mullet fisherman?" He goes, "No, the mullet guy from the Humane Society. He doesn't want us to hurt any of the mullet." And I said, "Did you explain to them that what we do with mullet is we put a hook through their heads and we throw them in the water to catch another fish?" He said, "I told him that." He said, "No, we can't hurt any mullet." So I said, "There's a scene where the kid has to, like, catch the mullet. And the kid, they're slippery. And so... And there's the guy's watching the whole time. He goes, "You're going to hurt the mullet. You're going to squeeze. He's going to kill the mullet." And the kids. So they have to bring, at the end of this whole day, and it's expensive to shoot, they decide, because the kid can't really hang on to the mullet, they're going to bring in a stunt mullet. And I said to Will, I said, "What's the stunt mullet going to be?" And they said, "You're bringing in a koi." I said, "A goldfish?" I said, "It's not even the right color. How can they bring in a koi to be a mullet?" And he said, "No, we're going to shoot it in a way. They're going to hold it in a way. Because the goldfish just lay there like a slab of nothing, and the kid can hang on to the goldfish." So anyway, so they shoot the scene with the stunt mullet. And and it looks okay, I guess. And so Will's done for the day, and he says to the guys, "Just dump the mullet. They're at the Intercoastal Waterway, a big waterway in Florida. Just let the mullet go." And the Humane Society guy starts having a conniption. He's going, "No, you can't let our mullet go in here." And he goes, "Will goes, why not? Look at all the other mullet." He goes, "No, all these mullet, my mullet, have to be delivered back to the mullet place, and they're have to be accounted for." And like they had names or something. I don't know. So the guy very protectively gathers up all his little, actor mullet, and off he goes with him. And this is why movies cost so much money, because I don't know what this cost, but it was just sheer, utter madness. So there were a lot of funny moments like that. And we had some great young actors, the kids who were acting, also some grown-ups. Luke Wilson's in it, and some a lot of good actors are in it. But the kids' moms are hanging around the set, and one of them got it, and they were going to shoot a scene in Silver Springs, Florida, and I guess someone had made the mistake of assuring her that it was a scene where the kid's supposed to jump in the water and swim around and do a little Huckleberry Finn thing, swimming around. And okay, yes, there are alligators in Silver Springs. There are, and there are some big ones, but usually it's not a problem. And I didn't see why you get so upset just because you see a couple alligators on the bank. Anyone who grew up in Florida, they're usually not going to bother you. Apparently they bothered her quite a great deal. So that scene was shot rather briefly, and they had to sort of dub in some other people swimming underwater. He wasn't really keen on, I guess they don't have a lot of those in California, those big 12-foot alligators swimming around. But in any case, they got the thing done, and I hope it turns out okay. The stuff I saw looked pretty funny, but now they take it back to Hollywood and put it in the hands of the Hollywood studio weasels, and there's no telling. By the end of it, there could be a fire-breathing dragon inserted in some computer way. So after all this stuff's going on with Hoot, it came time for me to decide whether I was going to write another kid's book or not. And I had written into my contract, I had a two-book contract with Hoot, but I had an escape clause that basically said if Hoot bombed, if it went right into the old commode, I wouldn't have to write another one, and the publisher wouldn't have to pay me for another one. We could both pretend that it never happened. We could just kind of go our separate ways. But, and Hoot did pretty well, and I couldn't really weasel out of the second book. So I sat down and I again sort of stole from my own experiences when I wrote Flush. This book takes place in the Keys, and it's a different set of characters, and it's told in the first person, which is something I really wanted to do. I wanted to have the main character in this book tell a story, and it's about a kid, and it opens on Father's Day. It's Father's Day, and he's visiting his dad in the Monroe County Jail. This is not a scene that hasn't happened before in the Keys, by the way. His dad has done a kind of a foolish thing. He's gone and sunk somebody else's boat, which in parts of the Keys is enough. If you get it to jail, you're lucky because at least you're still alive. You don't really sink other people's boats down there. And he's done it because it's polluting the water, and he didn't know how else to stop it. His dad gets carried away a little bit. So then the kid in the book, Noah, and his sister are sort of they've got to not only vindicate their father, they have to stop this bad guy from polluting. And again, it was sort of based on, we have a lot of, if you've ever been to the Florida Keys and you're driving across the Overseas Highway down towards Key West, it's just, it's incredibly beautiful on both sides of the road. And you can't imagine it's a place that's polluted at all. But the truth is a lot of the beaches down there are not safe. And for certain parts of the year, you can't go swimming. There's a lot of very nasty things floating in the water. And it's man-made. It's because the grown-ups are pretty careless about what they do. And so this was a story about how two kids were going to try to make a difference and try to stop. There's one little beach down there that I sort of modeled the fictitious Thunder Beach in this book was modeled after a place called Ann's Beach, which is not far from my house, which on any given weekend, if they do water sampling down there, you would not even let your worst enemy's dog go in the water at this place. And this is where all the people take their kids to go swimming. So it's a pretty harrowing kind of thing to think that this is allowed to happen. And we've had some spectacular pollution sort of issues in Florida, but in the book, the bad guy runs a casino boat, I'm sure you don't have casino boats here, but we have this clever thing in Florida where gambling isn't really legal, but if you have a big boat and you take it 3 miles offshore, you can have slot machines and poker and blackjack and roulette. People can gamble, and it's a lot of fun in about an 8-foot sea to be out there trying to play cards and have people throwing up on you. It's just what everyone goes to Florida to do, of course. Well, let's go out there and gamble 3 miles offshore. But the boats are always packed, and they have one of them in the Keys, it's just kind of a weird thing to do, but it's very, very popular. And so that's the boat in the book. But in real life, the polluters down there are much more. These cruise lines, the big cruise lines who advertise quite heavily on television, they, for years, what they would do before coming back to the port of Miami from their trips around the Caribbean would be, as soon as they got in the Gulf Stream coming back towards the port, they would throw all their crap overboard. Everything went overboard. Big garbage can bags full of garbage and everything else you can imagine right into the ocean, because it cost them a lot to have it trucked from the port of Miami to the dump. They had to pay a dump fee that they didn't want to pay. And since these companies only make about $5 or $6 million a day, they don't want to spring for the $500-$600 it takes to take the truck out there. So, and the way they caught them was very interesting, because they did it at night, and it was very difficult to prove what was going on, except these nitwits, what they would do, if you've ever been on one of these cruises, God help you if you have, but if you have been on them, you know there's always these guys with cameras following you around taking pictures of you and then try to sell you the picture. They live off this. I mean, no matter what you're doing, you're flossing your teeth, you're picking your nose, they take a picture and you want to buy the picture. Well, so bags and bags of photographs of tourists who did not want to buy their pictures were washing up on the shores in the Bahamas. So the people that live on these islands in the Bahamas, and stamped on the back of every picture was the name of the cruise ship on which the photograph was taken. Very slick crime. So anyway, the only thing that stopped this after many, many, many years was the federal government filed charges against one of the big cruise lines and fined them $5 million. And that got their attention. Then they started bringing their garbage back to port. But that's what it takes. That's the kind of, heavy-duty thing that it takes. In the Keys, they take a little, we have a little different sense of justice down there. If you know anything about the Keys, it has a long history of sort of piracy and smuggling. Since the smuggling went on through the 80s, believe me, in the days of what we call the square grouper, or bales of a certain substance that was grown in South America would wash up on shores, and you would talk to people, fishermen in fishing boats, where are you going today? Today I'm going to look for square grouper. And absolutely true. And I mean, so there's a little bit of an outlaw mentality in the Keys anywhere, which I thought would be sort of an interesting setting for this kind of a novel, where you have a lot of people kind of on the edge of the law, and then these kids who really believe in right and wrong and want to fix it. But I'll tell you one funny story about the Keys, which is true. This was a year or so ago. A bale of this substance, marijuana, it's known as, washed up on the beach of a neighbor of mine who lived on the ocean side of this island. And she called the Monroe County Sheriff's Department. She was having a big party that night. And she'd had the beach raked and manicured and the palm trees trimmed and the little tiki lights put out. And now there's 50 pounds of weed sitting on her. And so she calls the Monroe County Sheriff's Office and she says, I've got a bale of marijuana on my beach. Can you please send someone to come get it? And they said, oh, God, tonight we're kind of tied up. Maybe we'll drop by tomorrow and get it. Now, any other place, sirens are screaming, the police are out there. I said, no, we'll swing by tomorrow and pick it up. Just leave it on the beach. I'm not sure that it weighed the exact same amount the next morning that it did when the first call was made, but they came and got whatever was left, I think, after the party. But that's the Keys. That's really what goes on. This was very recently. So anyway, that's a little bit about the book and about the movie, and I promised to take as many questions as I could before they give me the slash signal. And I'd like to, especially if there's kids who want to ask questions, I'd really like to hear from them. Or criticism, for that matter. Somebody's taking a picture now. I see her down there. Oh, no, you go ahead. Go ahead. You can take your spot. I don't mean to scare you. Anybody got any questions? Yeah. What inspired me? Well, I liked the story about the owls because it was something that had happened to me. And I thought, well, here's a chance to make it turn out right. Some of the things that the kids do in that book to try to stop that from happening, I had tried to do when I was a kid, and I didn't succeed. My friends and I kind of failed. There's a scene, I think, where there's all these survey stakes in the ground, getting ready for the bulldozing, and the kids go and they mess up the survey stakes, and that's what we I have to say, I might have done that once or twice when I was a kid. We used to rearrange them kind of creatively. And then when the foreman would show up the next day, and he'd be his eyes would blink, and he'd have this thing out, and he couldn't figure out where everything went. Then they brought in security guys, and we couldn't do it anymore. But it just slowed him down. It didn't stop him. So I wanted to write a book where they got stopped, big time, and it just made me feel better to do that. Yeah, how did I research Team Road? And that was a small nonfiction book that I did about Disney. The Disney Empire, Team Rodent. And it was a big hit at Disney, by the way. I had done a bit of reporting about Disney. I had a file, and I knew a lot of people. And then I just, called people I knew, and it was really an essay. It was more of a... They'd call me up, and they were doing this series of books called The Library of Contemporary Thought. And they said, we got Jimmy Carter lined up, we got somebody, all these distinguished people lined up, and then we want you to write about something. And I thought, well, that's an odd thing. What are you really ticked off about? What could you do, 25, 30,000 words, small essay? And I said, I could do it on Disney. And I thought they'd not want to go. I figured they wouldn't want to do it on Disney. They said, sure, go on and do it on Disney. So, and I'd been over there many, many stories. I'd reported on a lot of things at Disney. And Disney has sort of changed Florida forever, in many, many ways, and not in good ways, in my opinion. So it was, and there's a corporate culture there that is completely opposite of the image that they portray. And I knew this from many, many people who worked there. I had some sort of inside stories. And so I said, okay, so I wrote the essay. And they published it. What I didn't realize was that Michael Eisner, who was the chairman of Disney at the time, the very same publisher that was asking me to do this was publishing his autobiography at the same time. I didn't know this. Yeah, so Eisner gets wind of my book, and he's a smart guy, and he knows right away it ain't going to be a Valentine. So he calls up my editor, and he says, I'd like to see the manuscript. I'd like to see Hyacinth's manuscript. And my editor, to his credit, says, we don't do that with manuscripts. You can't look at the manuscript before it comes out. Nobody can. So Eisner's all huffy about it. And then it comes out a little bit before his autobiography. He's really not happy because now he's got to go on a publicity tour in which he's being asked a lot about this book called Team Rodent. And he's not a hat, and he's like on NPR, he's trashing it. And I thought, this is great, because I believe in the end you're judged by your enemies. And I'm thinking, this is, I'll be very proud if this guy stays pissed off at me. This is like my dream come true. My goal had been for many, many years to get banned from Disney World. And I, because I figured it's going to get me off the hook. I knew that, you know, I had raised one son, and I had to take him a couple times to Disney World. And now we had a new baby, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to have to go back. If I could get officially banned, which had happened to a friend of mine. A friend of mine got officially banned from Disney World. I thought, if this book doesn't do it, nothing's going to do it. Then I can say to my wife, sorry, honey, I'd love to take you to Disney World, but they won't let me back on the property. And they never really officially banned me, but a friend of mine got banned. It was great, and he was. It was. I put the story in the book. He was on church night. They closed the park to everybody but church groups. Church groups from all over Florida go to Disney World. And my friend was very active in the church in Jacksonville, and he was the bus driver. And he drove the whole church over, and he and his wife, and then they're walking, they're having a great time at Disney World. And then they were going down an escalator, and some kids, some teenage kids said something to him, and these are church people, and they were saying some language that church people shouldn't have been saying to him. And then one of them either pushed or kicked his wife. So my friend reacted as many residents of Jacksonville who might have reacted. He grabbed the kid by the throat. And so that's when the security guys, they come out of the potted plants there. You never see them. No, it's true. There's the whole underground. They live underground. I'm not making this up. You'd never see these guys. They like pop out of the ground. And they grab him. And they take him to this kiosk. And he tells them, and he's got witnesses that support the fact that these kids were harassing his wife. Doesn't matter. They put him up against the wall. They take his mugshot front and side. These aren't even real police. These are like Disney cops. They're like the staff members. And they say, you know, you cannot come back here ever. And your photograph's going to be on the turnstile of every entrance. You're not allowed back. And they threw him out of the park, and he had to sit in the bus the rest of the night waiting for the rest of his church to come out. I thought it was a great story. Now, I didn't want to go grab somebody by the throat to get thrown out, but I had to. If he could do it, I could do it. So I figured the book would be just as good. And to this day, I haven't been banned. So it kind of failed at that level. Yeah, my writing routine. Well, that's good. I usually get up pretty early in the morning. The kids are up early. And so I start probably by 8:30. I'm in the office, and I work for a few hours. And I do take breaks. I know you hear from these writers that say, well, I start at 4 in the morning, and I write until noon. I don't believe a word of that. That's not – you can't do that. And write anything worth printing. You have to take breaks, and I do, and I'll write until I get tired. And once you get tired, which for me is usually early in the afternoon – maybe around 2 o'clock or so, I'll just knock off. And later in the evening, I may go back and edit and reread what I've written many, many times. And I continue to do it until the day I send the book off. I bet every chapter gets read, and I'm not exaggerating, anywhere from 25 to 30 times and edited. So it's a slow process, but that's pretty much what I try to do. One day a week, I write the column for the newspaper, and I don't work on the book at all that day. It's totally devoted to the column. And now some days, if you know you have the usual chaos and family situations, I may not get any writing done at all. I may get an hour. If I get 300 words written, it's great, you know. Okay, and then other days it may be 2,000 words. It just depends. Oh, you got two more. Here you go. Am I going to write another? You mean another book for kids? Yes, I'm in the middle of another grown-up book right now. When I finish that one, I have another book to write for kids. Yeah, thank you. And since you're sitting together, I'll let you do two questions. What was the point of tourist season? How old are you exactly? Because I'll give you one version of the point of tourist season. And then, did you read Tourist Season? Well, you want? Can I ask how old you are? You're 10. Okay, mom, dad. I would say 10 is maybe a bit young for Tourist Season. I'll tell you the point of Tourist Season was to scare as many people as I could away from the state of Florida, and I failed miserably at it. I thought, and it was, I had this idea that if I could terrorize people with words and just make them think that it might be dangerous to go, they would go away and leave me alone. And it didn't work that way. More people came because they liked the book, and so it kind of backfired on me. The real point of any, to answer your question seriously, the point of any writer's job, and I don't care what they tell you, it's not to preach or proselytize or to give, your job is to entertain. If you can't tell an entertaining story, it doesn't matter what you have to say because no one's going to read it and get it. So you have to entertain. And I've always tried to write funny books because humor is a great way to connect all different kinds of people together. And if you can't tell a story in a way that makes people laugh, then I haven't done my job. So, I mean, I don't set out with, like, a message or an agenda. I really don't. It's just a story that's supposed to work. What inspired me to write Flush? Well, as I said, I had a two-book contract, and if I didn't write Flush, they'd send lawyers after me. So I was inspired in that way. The truth is I had a lot of fun writing Hoot. I had a terrific time writing it, and I wasn't sure. It was very much an experimental thing. And when I finished Hoot, and then I did another adult novel in... After I finished Hoot, I wrote another grown-up novel, and I was ready. I was very, very eager and anxious to write another book for young readers because it was so much fun doing Hoot. And I had this story in my head that I wanted to tell. So I didn't really need much inspiration or motivation. It was just fun. It's got to be fun. If it's not, you know, I mean, if it's not fun, you shouldn't be doing it is the way I look at things. And I guess we're out of time. So I'll see you all up here. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Michael Connelly, Zadie Smith, Audrey Niffenegger, Nicholas Evans, Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Al Franken, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 28th, 2005.